Welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. I'm your host, Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. In this podcast, we discuss the latest cardiovascular research from Global Heart and other journals with leading experts in the field. In our second 2025 Global Heart Podcast episode, we are talking about the new WHO guidelines, the use of lower sodium salt substitutes. We divided this podcast in two conversations. We first talked with Professor Mary Labbé from University of Toronto, who is the director of the WHO Collaborating Center on Nutrition Policy for Chronic Disease Prevention, and she was also a member of the writing group of the recent guideline. We will hear from her about the why, the how, and what of this new, very important guideline. We then talk with Jaime Miranda, who is professor and head of the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. Jaime was also a reviewer of this guideline and wrote a very interesting editorial about these guidelines in Global Heart. Also, Jaime is one of the new senior editorial advisors of Global Heart, and we welcome both of them. We are very excited to have Professor Mary with us today. She was part of the writing group of the recent WHO guideline. So a very warm welcome, Mary.
Thank you very much.
I would like to start with a very broad question. Why did WHO decide to develop guidelines on lower sodium salt substitutes?
I mean, obviously, I'm not part of the WHO's decision making on, you know, how they prioritize which questions to ask. But I have been a member for a number of years on the dietary guidelines for diet and health. And WHO had very strong recommendations to reduce sodium levels. And of course, since those recommendations have come out, governments, health NGOs are looking for ways to reduce sodium. And one of the options that is out there has been food reformulation, but that's only been partially successful. But another potential option is the use of lower sodium salt substitutes in place of table salt in, you know, at the table and in cooking. So obviously, if that's one of the options, people are interested to know, is there evidence to support that as one of the interventions to lower sodium?
How big is as a problem now? I know that it's part of the WHO targets, and I just want to know how well we're doing as a world, and is this why this is a priority?
Well, I mean, sodium is a priority. It's one of the highest dietary priorities for WHO. The prevalence of hypertension is quite large. Obviously, cardiovascular disease is probably the highest preventable chronic disease around the world for most countries. With sodium, there's two different ways, and this is part of the challenge. We have many countries where their main sources of sodium are actually highly processed foods, where the food manufacturer has added sodium right into the food. But there are also other countries, and some of them are countries that aren't yet transitioned to a highly westernized type diet, and where their main sources of sodium are actually table salt and the salt added in cooking, and that elevates their sodium level. So obviously the strategy of food reformulation for those countries may not be that high a priority. And for other countries where there's high intakes of salt being added by consumers and at the table in cooking, those are really important to say, well, how can we lower that source of sodium?
How are we doing, if I ask you generally, the world, how is doing in terms of sodium consumption?
Not well. Very few countries, I don't think there's hardly any that are meeting the WHO target of 2 grams a day or 2,000 milligrams of sodium a day. Very, very few countries. I don't think any of them are really, any countries as a whole are meeting that target. And many countries are significantly above the WHO target. So we're not doing very well, unfortunately. Although I can say that some countries have had some reductions, but still not near to achieve the WHO targets.
So there's a clear argument why it's needed and it's a priority for WHO. You were part of the writing group. Can you tell us how these guidelines were developed in brief? I know it was a long process, very thorough. So can you explain a little bit to the audience how was the process?
Yeah, I mean, it follows all the WHO guidelines development follows the same process. I mean, it's evolved a bit over time, but it's the guidelines development process. And WHO has a document published that goes through the steps. But basically, once a question is posed to the committee to address, we go through several phases. The first step, often there's a scoping review to understand what the actual issues are, what the question is, that helps us frame that. And then based on the scoping review, the new GAG panel then develops what we call the PICO tables, which are standard, what's the population of interest, what intervention, in other words, what questions are we studying, what comparisons are we making? In this case, it's the use of low sodium salt substitutes versus table salt. The second question would be what outcomes? And that's one of the things the new GAG group says. Well, what are the main outcomes we're interested in? Well, obviously, with something like sodium, it's reducing sodium intakes, it's lowering incidences of stroke and cardiovascular disease. And when we go through, we scan for the whole realm of what the potential outcomes could be, and we choose priority ones, because obviously we could have 5, 10, 12 potential outcomes. But New GAG then says these are our priority outcomes. These are the ones that will be most important for decision making. And then what time periods? In other words, if you're looking at the studies, how long does the intervention do we expect should be to include in our studies? So those PICO questions, once we formulated them, are usually WHO sends them out for consultation to get some feedback. There are things we have omitted. And then after that, the WHO will contract with usually an expert group, a Cochrane collaboration group who've worked in the field, to conduct the systematic reviews and meta-analysis based on obviously the PICO questions that the new GAG committee has developed. Then, after the draft systematic reviews are ready, WHO, the new GAG committee, usually meets both with the systematic review committee. WHO often invites a couple of technical experts right in that field to contribute to the discussions. They don't vote, but they help us answer questions if we have. Then, when we're together, we look at the results of systematic review. Sometimes we say, for example, might ask the panel to do some subgroup analysis if we see a lot of heterogeneity to understand where that heterogeneity may come from. Then, when we have the evidence, obviously those evidence reviews, the groups that conduct them usually publish them as, in peer-reviewed journal literature. That process is usually happening at the same time that we're now developing our guidelines. So we use the systematic review and the meta-analysis then to develop the guidelines. And the guidelines follow a grade process. In other words, the quality of the evidence for the outcomes that we've identified, and also examine the contextual factors. In other words, cost effectiveness of the program or the values, because are they implementable, basically? We come up with draft recommendations based on the evidence and these contextual factors. Those documents, that draft guidelines, are then submitted again for both external experts for review as well as for external consultation. And the final step is then, based on the comments we get, we come up with our final guideline that's published by World Health.
Thank you very much, Marianne. It is a very thorough process, and we will put the link at the bottom of this podcast. I encourage all our audience to read that document methodologically. It's very interesting, and you can see how thorough and step by step you went. How long did the whole process take?
They usually take a couple of years to do all the steps. And I think partly it's how fast the reviews are done, how long the consultations are, and but it's usually a minimum of about 2 years, 2.5 years sometimes, as long as that, to get through a review process.
And I've been involved myself in some process using GRADE. I think it's a great approach, and particularly will come to some of the implementation considerations that I think, and other things beyond the evidence of clinical trials that I think it's very important to consider. We'll come back to that. But before, can you summarize the main findings of the systematic review of what the evidence showed? Maybe I know you look at many different outcomes. Maybe you can highlight the main findings.
Yeah, so the main recommendation is that the use of low salt substitutes are recommended with a conditional recommendation. And so a strong recommendation is one where WHO is encouraging all governments to go forward with that recommendation. With a conditional recommendation, it says that there's evidence behind, and it's usually, in this case, the evidence was low to medium, so from very low to medium. WHO for these guidelines came up with a conditional recommendation because they recognize that there are circumstances where low sodium salt substitutes may not be the recommended for all people.
Before we get into the recommendations, Mary, the systematic review look at certain outcomes. So can you summarize which were the outcomes that you look and what were the findings?
Yes, so the main outcomes were reducing blood pressure, both systolic and diastolic pressure. The mean reduction was actually 2.43 milligrams of mercury reduction for diastolic blood pressure and 4.76 milligrams for systolic pressure. So those are very significant reductions, and that was came with a moderate certainty of evidence.
And again, the audience can look at the details, but changing blood pressure, that was one of the main outcomes. And in terms of population,
At a population level, they also found that it had moderate reductions in reduce of stroke, non-fatal stroke, but also acute coronary symptoms, a 30% reduction in coronary disease with the use of the low sodium substitutes. Those were the main endpoints that drove the guideline recommendation.
and one thing that it's very detailed in the guideline is that the population that you found mainly were adults, because there was only, I think, one study for children, and in general, pregnant women were excluded. Can you tell a little bit about which population has been excluded from these trials? Because I think that had an implication eventually when you made the recommendations.
Exactly. So we go by what we have evidence for. And in this case, the studies that were conducted were primarily all in adults. There was none in pregnant women. And I think, as you said, one study in children. So the recommendations are really focused on adults. The studies that we actually saw, they virtually all of them, almost all of them, excluded people that had problems with either impaired kidney function or kidney disease. So they were excluded from the studies, and they are an at-risk group. So in a sense, the results are not generalizable to a whole population where you have not the ability to diagnose if people have chronic kidney diseases. So that is another consideration in those guidelines, that the studies that were used had pre-screened the participants for having risk of kidney disease.
Thank you, Mary. And so now going back to the recommendations, you were saying that WHO also made conditional recommendation. And so what is the main recommendation? Can you summarize it?
Yes, I mean, the main recommendation is the use of low sodium salt substitutes in place of table salt for use in the home. Unfortunately, we had very little evidence whether it would be a good substitute by manufacturers for replacing processed foods, their salt in that. So really, the evidence was using the low sodium salt substitutes as a replacement for table salt in the home, on the table, and in cooking.
Was there any major debate? I'm sure in any of these processes, there are a lot of discussions, but could you highlight one of the areas that was more controversial?
I think two things kind of came up. One, that many countries don't use that much salt, sodium. The campaigns to lower, the use of salt at the table and in cooking have been quite successful. So obviously there was concern that if we start recommending low salt substitutes, people may get back in the habit of adding salt back, reacclimatizing their taste acuity to high saltier foods. So it may undermine what have been successful public health campaigns in many countries to lower the consumer's use of salt. So that was one of them. And of course, you have many countries that the other debate was, well, in these countries, they're still using a lot of table salt. And in those countries, it could be very advantageous to have those consumers who are already using a lot of salt to use a low sodium salt substitute.
Is there any, I'm sure there are regional differences, but a simple way of this difference between discretionary use and non-discretionary use in terms of high-income countries, regions? Can you summarize what's the
Yeah,
difference?
it tends to be the high-income countries who have most of their sodium coming from processed foods. That was probably more the case, but unfortunately, what we're seeing is many of the low and medium-income countries are transitioning to a more Western diet, which comes along with a lot more processed foods with a lot more sodium in those foods. So it's not a hard and fast rule, and you can look at South America and you can say, Brazil has a high amount of sodium that still comes from use at the table, while Chile, right beside it, has got more packaged foods. They're not low under, developed countries. They're at least medium developed countries. So there's not a hard and fast rule, but it tends to be whether the country has transitioned to a lot of processed foods. Those tend to come along with a lot of sodium already in the food supply. And of course, if the sodium is already in your pasta sauce, you don't have to add as much at the table.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So Mary, you come with very clear recommendations, and I think it's a very welcome guideline. But of course, we know that from policies and guidelines to real implementation, there are always many challenges. Which are the main challenges to implement these recommendations?
I think some of the challenges that were identified, particularly by countries where I would call they don't have a real highly supported healthcare system. And in those countries, many of them don't have routine diagnosis of, say, for example, kidney function. And that's particularly as, people age and where it's higher prevalence of reduced kidney function. And so in those countries, it's a little more challenging because they don't have the ability to have the, screening for the at-risk groups. A country where there's a high level of, routine, what I would call primary care, is probably easier to do. So I think that was one of the concerns. And I mean, there were some concerns about cost. Salt substitutes are more expensive than table salt relative to the cost of the food. It's still a small amount. The actual ingredients wasn't that high, but people still did raise the issue of, being a cost prohibitive. And then the third item that was raised is the issue around salt iodization. Obviously, many countries have developed, calibrated their salt iodization programs, the amount of iodine that they add to their salt based on the traditional salt intakes of their country. And obviously, if you're going to reduce the sodium table salt, sodium chloride at the table, then you may have to recalibrate your salt iodization programs. So that was one other issue that was raised.
I guess for the last point, definitely it's something to consider, but because the recommendations are mainly for adults and excluded children and pregnant women, maybe, although it has a role, of course, maybe it's not a major issue. I don't know. You are the expert on this, Mary. I mean, that was.
I mean, the most at-risk groups for iodine deficiency are obviously pregnant women and young children. And they are not in the salt substitutes. The problem with salt substitutes when you're replacing table salt used in the home is not always exclusively used by one member of the household. It could be on the table for every household member. So it's not always kept as two sources of salt in the household.
Okay, so just to finish this very interesting conversation, Mary, I want to ask you two questions. One, when the World Health Federation, we have many members that they work on advocacy, on policy. So what do you think organization like that should be doing regarding these guidelines? And then the other audience that we have, of course, are researchers. So tell me a few research gaps that were identified through this guideline, and I'm sure many of our audience will be keen on considering future research on this topic.
Yeah, and I think when you do the systematic review, you always find out how many gaps there actually are. And obviously, we raised a couple earlier, probably were some of the reasons why we came up with a conditional recommendation. There's virtually no evidence in pregnancy, children, the whole measure of, hyperalkemia, that risk. I mean, it's not well quantified, and what level of kidney functioning, that sort of those areas aren't that well defined. Also, one of the things, and we looked at the evidence, these low sodium salt substitutes, they're not a consistent product. So you'll have some products that varied with the amount of potassium, the amount of sodium. And, is there an optimal level? I don't know. I think the ranges were quite varied in the studies that we looked at for the relative amounts of sodium chloride and potassium chloride. There was virtually no evidence on whether these would be useful to lower the sodium levels in processed foods. For example, because obviously in many countries that's the main source of sodium, and would these help to lower the sodium levels if manufacturers use those? There was very little evidence that we had to look at that. I mean, I think this goes along with the whole problem with sodium. Many studies don't really measure sodium intakes that well, whether they measure, 24-hour urines, and then if they use spot urines, I mean, that's good at a population level, but it's not that good for an individual level of measuring their sodium status. So intricate with the problems with the low sodium salt substitutes is the whole research around, accurately quantifying the sodium intake of individuals, which is harder to do than a population level. You can look at large number of samples, say this is the mean of the population, it's the distribution, but it's more challenging to look at the actual sodium level of an individual.
Going back, and this is a very good example where there is some uncertainties and research questions, but also you have some evidence of things that and concrete recommendations. So that brings me back to my first question, where what do you think members from WHF and WHF advocacy and policy organization should be doing with these guidelines?
Well, I think first and foremost, to support the reduction of sodium by populations. I mean, sodium intakes are high. If they know, especially if they're in advocacy, they know what the sodium intakes at their population level are, then I think they can advocate for the most effective sodium reduction policies that are appropriate to the context that their countries are, whether it's the main or processed foods, whether the main sources are the like sodium added to the table. And then we have a third group of countries who I would say many of their sodium high intakes come from what I would call condiments, these fish sauces, these cube powders that are added to foods that are very popular. I know in Latin America, many of the countries use a lot of those sachets of flavorings. But I've heard someone call them a little sodium bomb, But so I think the advocacy really is around sodium reduction. And then what's the most effective way in your circumstances of your area or region to help promote the sodium reduction? And being a person who's looked at the food supply, there's several popular proposals that are, policies that have been intervened. Obviously, we've had sodium reformulation. I would say they've been of mixed effectiveness. Unless they're really followed up closely by governments, you might get a flurry of activity early on of these what I would call the easy ones to do, and then industry sort of loses interest and you don't get sustained reduction. Other area that I think happens is many governments have been implementing front-of-pack labeling, which is some form of a symbol, whether it's a warning symbol or traffic lights, to identify foods that are high in sodium. We've seen other policies where schools and restaurants, governments are asking them to remove salt shakers from the table, so you have to specifically ask for it. So that's a disincentive. Others have regulated the size of those little sodium sachets that should be smaller. So I think there's a number of policy programs that are also helping to lower sodium reduction. And of course, you've got some countries have actually taxing junk foods that are high in sodium or sugar. So not just sodium, but sometimes sugars, saturated fats, they all help to lower the sodium, whether they're specifically focused on sodium or looking at what I would call nutrients of risk or public health concern.
The guideline makes, I think, a good job on putting this into the context of other recommendations. I mean, this is another tool. It calls to all the important actors to use all the tools that WHO has on the SHAKE package. For
Exactly.
so to finish, I want to thank you, Mary. We have the pleasure to talk with Professor Mary Labbé, who was part of the cooking of this guideline, talking about salt. And it's great to hear exactly, I mean, how it was done and what were the implications. I'm sure it will be very impactful. To finish this podcast, we'd like to ask your very simple answer of what you understand by global cardiovascular research.
Sure. I was a department chair for many years, and I think the same model I could apply to a whole department of nutrition to global cardiovascular research. I think it has three main pillars, and they all should be strong. We absolutely have to understand the clinical ramifications of how to reduce cardiovascular disease in a clinical setting. That could be primary prevention or secondary prevention, particularly secondary prevention when you're talking clinical populations. I think, as I raised today, there's many what I would call underlining basic biomedical questions of, the sodium metabolism, how this sodium potassium function, how they're handled by the kidney in various phases. So I think there's some basic biomedical questions. And then of course the area that I work on, I think there's a large amount of research in this sort of what I would call public health policies. How do you change population intakes? How do you do it in cost-effective ways? And efficacy, how do these interventions actually work to get populations to change? And if you're a government, they have to be cost effective. I mean, governments are these day and age are very focused on costs. So I think, if you look at cardiovascular research, I think they all have parts of those three focus, and whether we're working one and the other. And then I think it's good that if I'm an expert in public health, I have to be talking to my colleagues in clinical to say, are patients actually going to do this and will it work that way too? So.
And I think salt is a really good example of those three pillars that you mentioned. So thank you again, Mary, for being with us today. It has been a pleasure. Again, we will have the link to the latest guideline, and I suggest to all our audience to read the guideline. It's really important and a very good read. Thank you, Mary, again.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Welcome, Jaime. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Global Heart podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In your editorial at Global Heart, you made some very compelling arguments about the importance of this new WHO guideline. But I'd like to focus on just a few of them for our conversation today. To start, you frame salt substitution not only as a dietary change, but as an important public health intervention and very much aligned Jeffrey Rose's concept of shifting the population risk curve. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that and why it's important?
Yes, I think this is very time sensitive because for the first time, these guidelines bring the conversation outside of the clinical field. And the recommendations of the WHO are very, very specific in the sense of providing advice for this intervention to be used at home. Now, I want to emphasize that point because up to now, all the wealth and the body of evidence has been focused on clinical trials, and particularly with very strict eligibility criteria. Back a few decades, most of those trials were hospital-based and clinic-based. And more recently, we have seen how those trials have been shifting towards community or population type of interventions. So having that endorsement from WHO is crucial. It's crucial because it moves the conversation away from a clinical tool into a population intervention. And why it matters? Because in terms of absolute numbers, the population hosts and harbors the majority of people. And having this intervention available across the population will mean that a lot of individuals will benefit from such intervention, not only the high risk. And here's a bit of self-reflection and self-criticism as well. Cardiology is one of the most trained and educated fields in terms of research, particularly clinical trials. But we have seen over the years how these groups of that become or ended up being studied end up being subgroups of subgroups of subgroups. So having something massive population-wise enables us across society to have interventions that can bring good to all of them. So that is really important. And the concept of Geoffrey Rose is a good reminder nowadays that these type of interventions, population-wide interventions, tap onto, in absolute numbers, the majority of people are there, but it's not to oppose the clinical high-risk approach. So I think it's good that we are adding something else to our ammunition of interventions to prevent cardiovascular disease. In summary, it's quite good to have those two. So the cardiovascular field benefits, the population benefits, and also this idea that we can do prevention outside of the clinic, we can do prevention outside of a consultation, it's terribly important.
That's great, and I agree with you completely that it's not one or the other, and but that the importance, and it's true, sometimes we can miss those small changes at the population level that have a huge impact. So your public health view on that, I think it's a really nice aspect of your editorial about why this is important, that it might not be obvious for, but like if you think with your kind of clinical mindset, because you're talking about small changes. Another interesting point you make in your editorial is that you say salt substitution is a game changer on par with statins and antiretrovirals. And you say, as usual, as you are provocative, and you say transformative interventions are often implemented even before long-term outcome data are fully available. So can you explain why that's the case here and how it applies for salt substitution?
Yes, and here I'm trying to push my own community, right? And look, we come into the world with, and rightly so, with our strength, we care and we want to do good, but we come with very robust, high standards in terms of safety. And safety, it's an important word. We all agree with that, and we don't want to lower the bar in terms of quality. So safety is crucial. Yet, as you can see, most of the trials and also most of the trials conducted today have always faced and encountered the challenge of what would happen if. And rightly so. At the beginning and the early days, we had to build the evidence, and the body of evidence keeps growing and growing and growing. So from clinical trials, very small, where people with chronic kidney disease, and in particular, that is the group that remains heavily understudied. if they have kidney problems, they obviously there are problems in their function and the handling of the potassium. Introducing externally an extra source of potassium may challenge that equilibrium. Fair point. So initially, most of the studies included them, but we can see how over time, it's not that we have been lowering the bar, but the more that the study have become available, the more that we have been able to see these interventions in real life. So, for example, there was a large study in China in elderly care homes, and it was also introducing this all. And we will expect that most of the elderly population would have some sort of reduced kidney functions, and it went well. We did a study in Peru as well. We excluded people who knew they had problems with kidneys, but also because of the challenges of a low-resource settings, many people don't have access to diagnosis, and many people may have had problems, undiagnosed problems. And still, we did not find problems. So the point being is that perhaps now we are at that stage where we can do the study specifically among people with kidney disease. But waiting to do more studies, that's a challenging point that I want to put forward, is that is a game changer. Being a public health intervention, we need to roll out and we need to scale up. But also we need to roll out and scale up responsibly. And then I do this, I compare, I do the similitudes with statins or with antiretrovirals. We couldn't wait 15 or 20 years to have enough long-term follow-up to release, to introduce the benefit. And I think we can be caught in this idea of perfectionism versus burden. And I would argue that rolling out responsibly, introducing in simultaneously mechanisms to monitor side effects will be a huge benefit population-wide and globally. This crowd and this particular community knows of the burden of cardiovascular disease. This particular audience knows the burden of hypertension. This particular audience know that health systems are constrained, overburdened, spread too thin, etc. So why not introduce an intervention that will it has demonstrated to yield benefits, but equally introduce it with the responsibility of monitoring? Now, have we done it before? Yes, we have. So we have mechanisms to monitor side effects. Most recently, 3 years ago, with the vaccine, we have implemented mechanisms to keep alert, to keep an eye. So we have the solution, we have the expertise, and we have prior experience. So I would argue that is a game changer for cardiovascular prevention globally.
Excellent. And I think, again, it's a kind of second nature to you. You bring your public health perspective, because if you think, what's the benefit of the public health? You think overall there is some benefit. And of course, the issue of potassium, we discussed with Mary Labbé, and she explained some of the findings on the guideline. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of clinical discussion on that. But I think it's very interesting in your editorial, the case you make from a public health perspective. Another interesting point that you make in your editorial, that you're very good at bringing different angles and help us think always differently, Jaime. And I like how you highlight this strategy. So you help us zooming out in general, so with public health, but even beyond, because you said is not this intervention can affect many of the sustainable development goals beyond health. And I know you work on this with the United Nations. Can you give us some explanation of why you think that's the case for salt substitution?
Yeah, and I think this idea for me has two purposes. One is to serve our internal community and also our external audiences. Yeah, so from within health and outside health. I come with my training and my work. I had the opportunity to co-chair the Global Sustainable Development Report, the most recent one in 2023, where we were tracking progress on the SDGs. And it was a very, very well-established and mature group of thinkers from the world, and all of them were from multiple sectors across society. And it were interesting to see, to be the one or the only, there were a couple, the two ones of health, and we have to engage into this conversation. So how can we progress and how can we make progress with that towards a common goal? And the lesson there was that, okay, yes, whatever we do across our fields or in our field will have impacts and repercussions. We can bring it closer to us. We can think about complex science or system thinking. Everything is connected. And the idea of the SDGs is the Sustainable Development Goals is that they are connected as well. So the education within our sector is to say, let's push ourselves outside of our health field. Well, salt substitution traditionally could be placed easily as a nutrition intervention. We have an SDG that relates to that, or very close to us, a health intervention. Absolutely, yes. But how can we connect with these other sectors across? And that's an important one. The first and obvious one, with this population entry point, we're benefiting societies. And the fact that we're benefiting societies means that we have adults in the workforce that are contributing to the economy. And why not? So it's a health intervention that has immediate effect into having a healthier working population. Wouldn't that be great and ideal? Who doesn't want to have a healthier working population that can be more productive during the age? And also, as you know, living without being hypertension free and particularly being complications free, it's a massive reduction in burden, not only to a healthcare sector and the health systems, but equally having healthier workforce means that people are contributing better and longer. So that is an amazing and quick win. Number two, everybody talks about climate change and what's the connection for us? And this one was in writing this editorial was a bit of an exercise for me. Can I push myself to think that there's a connection between salt substitutes and the climate? And the obvious is that the current production of salt that we consume every day is not climate neutral. And then I was doing it more and more, I found out that the mining of salt requires access to large areas of land that you need to for the salt to dry out. Interestingly, the location of those salt mines is not that they are outside. They are connected. They are very somewhat, some of them are very close to villages or to places where humans live. And learning from other fields, I'm seeing that the having those huge concentrations of salt means that the salt also percolates and filtrates into the soil and into the water. So there's have these additional effects of salt mining that we are not bringing into the equation. Now, will salt substitute be climate neutral? Not necessarily, but we have to confront the question as well and make decisions. And we're always better off making informed decisions. So it's interesting to see that because it's a ubiquitous product that it's everywhere, it's not necessarily good for societies and good for the planet. And maybe it's a bit of a time of a reflection to say, what is the connection between salt and climate? Lastly, and importantly, is for us, and I've been reflecting quite a bit on this, we train also, Pablo, you and I, we share this training as clinical doctors, right? So we're very good at telling others what to do. We're very good that you have to do that. And we bring that into public health as well. Well, you have to do that. You know, education sector, you have to educate your people. And what is interesting for salt substitutes is one of those areas that the industry will be willing to work with us. It's one of those areas where government will be willing to work with us. And we need to learn and step into those challenges. Now, there are specific goal 17, number 17, that talks about partnerships. And I think it's interesting for us because we have framed the conversation with industry around black and white. And here, without the industry, we cannot increase the supply of potassium. Without government, we cannot produce or come up with incentives for the supply channels and for penetration of the product at large scale. So we need to learn and a bit of humility for us to learn to integrate better, but also we have something good to bring to the table across all these actors in society. So it's quite interesting that even a single product, salt substitute, is pushing us as a community to bring benefits to health. But it was also an opportunity to push us, to teach us, and to learn us to engage better and more across society. And at the end of the day, we have these health in all policies, and I think this is a good excuse for us to get us out there.
That's great. It's very interesting to do this exercise, I'm sure, and force us to think how it relates with other areas. And I'm sure also when we're trying to make the case, I think linking to certain things like commercial impact and so on, it is something that can be helpful to consumer advocacy.
And Pablo, let me complement that because it's interesting. When we were doing this Global Sustainable Development Report, it was like, okay, but at the end of the day, some policies will have to rely on interventions. Then how can we capture this? So it was this invitation which just did this reflection on how this intervention taps onto multiple SDGs. The recommendation of the report invites us to say, for every single policy, we need to proactively map out potential effects and think about the interactions and the synergies across SDGs. And if there are some counterbalances, we also need to be proactive. And that's an interesting framing as well, because it will help us advance simultaneously by documenting these hypotheses of interlinkages, synergies, and trade-offs.
We will put the link to the report because I think it's a very interesting read on top of the guideline and your editorial. I think it's going to be interesting for our audience. So let me move on just to finish our conversation, Jaime. You already covered a little bit of this because as a public health practitioner and you talk about implementing, but also you already referred a little bit about research as an academic. What do you think are the key research priorities after this guideline that we still interesting research questions that we need to pursue?
I'd say I have in my mind a few areas of research. Obviously, clinical will always have clinical questions, and there are many experts that will signal the gaps with the current recommendations. In particular, one of the areas that I'm keen to explore is how do we do with people with transplants? I mean, these people obviously who recently have had a kidney transplant, can we engage them into healthier habits? And is salt, low sodium salt, an option with it? And again, that will put me in the frame of very, very careful approach. But why not? We shouldn't deny the good things for people. And definitely, it will open up an area of research in the field of kidney disease, importantly. The other area has to do with prevention as well. So our field of cardiology is quite reliant on cardiovascular guidelines. And I wonder if my patient is less so, but I think if guidelines were to be updated and there's a type of non-research to be entered into the guideline, but what kind of research could be influencing the guidelines as to sort of monitoring, progressing, or a heat map, which guidelines of the world are uptaking this intervention or not? Not so there's a bit of a different observation. The units of observations are guidelines. The third one, I will move outside to the community as well. So maybe can we think about prevention and use it as a prevention initiative? So right now, pre-hypertension has been there with the criticism and not, but still we know that over a year, a number of people will transition towards the status of hypertension. And I wonder if this tool can help us prevent that. So there are three or four areas in our field of health where I see further research is needed. Then I move into, and let's switch gears and switch hat. I'll move towards more operational type of research, but it's type of supply side of research. And I'm thinking with an engineering and with a supply mindset, I will argue that we need to put this low sodium salt in every household. Well, is Amazon going to distribute it, or is it community kitchens, or is it the schools? So what are the delivery mechanisms for that? What are the storage required for that? Who's going to pay for that, right? So let's assume that the product exists and we need to put it on the household. How do we make that? Is it transport? Does it all have to come from an unknown country or somewhere in the planet? So we haven't thought about this because right now it has been sold as a boutique type of product. So we need to make it universal, right? And there are some challenges there. So that's the supply side. And then thirdly, I'd say it's on the incentives for the production. So how do we work with government? Is it that we require economic incentives, or is it require economic policies, or do we require law? Or do we see that we require a certain arrangement? So as you can see, we can move from the clinical, we can move from the operational, but actually we need an ecosystem that makes this possible. And I'm very keen to explore these questions as well on these more ecosystems type of things, because we need to work together.
So I'm sure our audience would realize that Jaime has a lot of ideas. I thought that he might have a one or two research questions. He already has a huge portfolio. And the interesting thing, we didn't have time to talk today. Jaime led a very interesting study in Peru about salt substitution. And we will also put the link, I think, below the podcast. It was cited, I think, in the guideline, Jaime, no, as well. And it was one of the few studies done in low and middle income countries. That, I think, can be a subject of another podcast because it was quite an interesting story how to publish. It was finally published in Nature, if I'm correct. But I think Jaime not only has very interesting comments, but then he does the research. So I'm sure this is the first, but it will not be the last time that we talk with Jaime in the podcast. So to finish, we always ask our guest, Jaime, a simple but very complicated question. We want a simple answer. So your definition, global cardiovascular research.
We put all my eggs in one word, reciprocity. And this comes with my personal bias or my personal experience, having trained in multiple locations and having benefited from exposure to multiple groups and countries. And reciprocity is one of those words that for me aligns closely and is one of the fundamental pillars of global health. And I think for global cardiovascular research, I wouldn't trade that off. So I will keep it reciprocity, which means not doing the same thing. And Pablo, let me reflect on this. In the UK, when you go to the pub, you will buy rounds of drinks and you say, this round is mine, right? And it's not that you come with tequila for everybody. No, people will say, well, I want some, I want this, I will pass, I will go. Next time, somebody else will buy next round, right? And that element of having to enjoy that and to be treated with respect, and but also not with respect, but to be invited to enjoy and to contribute, it's amazing. So I always use that, that example of being on a pub, on an English pub, and doing research mean that this round is yours, but next round is somebody else's. But you don't impose, and you accept, and you wait to be offered a drink. And the emphasis that you accept and you wait to be offered the drink, for me, means this: the activation of this dual channel of reciprocity. And here I'm talking with my Peruvian hat and my Latin hat. We have ideas, we have connections, we have willingness to do good things, and it's just, we're just waiting for that environment where reciprocity can flourish.
That's fantastic, and I think you can. I'm sure everyone feels. I mean, I can feel it, Jaime, when you give this fantastic example, that another component of doing global cardiovascular research is that we enjoyed a lot, because that what you just described, it's not only reciprocity, but it's something that is enjoyable. I mean, I'm sure most of our audience will have enjoyed as well this conversation. Thank you again, and I'm sure we'll have you again in the podcast. Thank you, Jaime.
Thank you very much. And everybody, go to the household and swap your salt.
To our listeners, you'll find below the links to the WHO guidelines, Jaime's editorial, and also some of the papers and reports that Jaime mentioned in our conversation with him. We also put a link to Season with Sense, that is a public health campaign that WHF is involved to help reduce sodium intake. And as always, stay tuned for our monthly Global Heart podcast, where we'll keep exploring the latest in global cardiovascular research. Thanks for listening, and until next time.